From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Novelist Terry McMillan has been called the creator of a new literary genre, the post-feminist black urban romance novel. McMillan writes about love, but she's not trying to be Danielle Steele. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Terry McMillan about why being single isn't as much fun as it used to be. Also, playwright John Robin Bates has just been awarded $15,000 from the National Endowment for the Arts. But for him, it's a dubious honor. He's accepted the grant, but he's giving $15,000 of his own money to two arts organizations whose grants were recently vetoed by the head of the NEA. Coming up, Bates reads his letter to the NEA and tells us why he's making this act of protest. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Bush administration announced that President Bush plans to extend most favored nation trade status for China, despite congressional concerns over that country's record on human rights and missile proliferation. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
The administration says it is wrong to use trade policy to isolate China if the United States hopes to have any influence there. In a statement released late this afternoon, spokesman Marlon Fitzwater acknowledged the objections many lawmakers have towards granting the trade benefits to China. He said the Chinese government's respect for internationally recognized human rights is insufficient, and that the administration is trying to elicit a faster pace for human rights improvements. But he argued that withdrawing the trade benefits from China would not help achieve those objectives. Fitzwater added that there has been progress on nuclear nonproliferation, and he said that American businesses and consumers would suffer from a withdrawal of most favored nation trade status. Congress now has 90 days in which to try to block the president's action. I'm Richard Gonzalez at the White House.
Congressional investigators said today that the government has failed to go after at least $1 billion in potential civil claims against the officials of failed banks and thrifts. Harold Valentine of the General Accounting Office said that the Resolution Trust Corporation and the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation haven't hired enough lawyers and investigators to do the job. The agencies estimate that more than 75% of the bank and thrift failures involved wrongdoing, but Valentine says the FDIC files civil suits in only 20% of its cases. He says the RTC only files suits in 41%. Spokesmen for both agencies disputed the GAO charges. Voter turnout is moderate in Alabama, where most of the attention is focused on congressional rather than presidential balloting. Debbie Elliott of member station WUAL reports.
Republican Pat Buchanan is the only presidential candidate who visited Alabama in the few weeks before today's primaries. But the campaigning for Congress has been vigorous. Pollsters say voter turnout is critical in the U.S. Senate race, where incumbent Democrat Richard Shelby faces a strong challenge from Chris McNair, a county commissioner from Alabama's largest county, which includes Birmingham. Polls show Shelby is leading 62% to 28%, but McNair, who is black, is expected to benefit from high voter turnout in Alabama's first majority black U.S. House district. McNair could also benefit from rarely hotly contested Republican congressional races in Alabama, which could depress white turnout in the Democratic primary, siphoning off some of Shelby's support. For National Public Radio, I'm Debbie Elliott reporting.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 17 points to close at 3,396. This is NPR News. Fighting continued today in and around Kabul, the capital of Afghanistan. An Islamic fundamentalist group supported by Iran is fighting the interim Islamic government. The fighting renews doubts about the ability of the coalition government to control the various factions that ousted President Najibullah. It also raises questions about Iran's intentions in Afghanistan. The Iranian-backed guerrillas are reported to be holding as many as 130 government buildings and key installations around Kabul, most of them displaying portraits of the late Ayatollah Khomeini. Israeli authorities have closed a Palestinian university on the West Bank after disturbances there. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
A Najah University in Nablus was opened just 8 months ago after being closed for most of the Palestinian Intifada since December 1987. Israel Radio reported that Defense Minister Moshe Arons accepted the recommendation of security forces to close the university for 1 week beginning Wednesday because of violent disturbances there. The university was only reopened after faculty promised that the university would not be a center for violence and would only be an academic institution. Palestinians protested the closure order, saying they should have the right to demonstrate. All Palestinian universities were closed for most of the past 4.5 years. Bir Zeit University, which was seen as one of the focal points of the uprising, reopened in April. So far, there has not been any violence there. I'm Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
Congressional leaders said today that a secret bomb shelter for lawmakers has become obsolete and should no longer be maintained. The bomb shelter was built on the grounds of a luxury resort in West Virginia. Its existence was revealed in news reports last week. House Speaker Thomas Foley said today that he's notified the Defense Department that Congress no longer has any interest in maintaining the shelter. He said he asked the Secretary of Defense to see if the facility could be put to any other government use. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Terry McMillan's new novel was published this week, and it went immediately to number 6 on the New York Times bestseller list. Waiting to Exhale tells the story of four women whose friendships support them through their troubled relationships with men. They are, as McMillan puts it, waiting to exhale, waiting for that man who will take their breath away. In a review of the book in the New York Times, Susan Isaacs noted the novel is about more than four lives. The bonds among the women are so alive and so appealing, they almost seem a character in their own right. Waiting to Exhale is McMillan's third novel. It follows Mama and Disappearing Acts. 2 years ago, she edited an anthology of contemporary African-American fiction called Breaking Ice. Before we talk, McMillan will read from the opening of Waiting to Exhale.
Right now, I'm supposed to be all geeked up because I'm getting ready for a New Year's Eve party that some guy named Lionel invited me to. Sheila, my baby sister, insisted on giving me his phone number because he lives here in Denver, and her simpleton husband played basketball with him 11 years ago at the University of Washington. And since I'm still single, which is downright pitiful to her, considering I'm the oldest of four kids and the only one who has yet to say I do, she's worried about me. She and Mama both think I'm out here dying of loneliness, which is not true. I mean, I have my days and I have my nights, but I haven't gotten to the point where I'll take whatever I can get. There's a big difference between being thirsty and being dehydrated. But Sheila and Mama have always thought that something was better than nothing, and look where it's gotten them. Mama, who thinks she's an expert on everything, hasn't had a whole man in her life for 17 years. And if I knew where my daddy was, I'd probably kill him for making her such a bitter woman. He broke her heart, and she's never recovered. And Sheila, she files for divorce on an annual basis and calls me collect from some cheap motel where she and the kids are hiding out until she can serve the papers on Paw. I listen to her whine for hours about how sick she is of him and that there's nothing he can do or say that would make her go back this time. But then, like a fool, she turns right around and calls him up, repeats her long list of needs that aren't being met, and he promises to give her anything she wants. She refuses to believe him, so he begs on a daily basis for 2 weeks, and by then he's convinced her that he means it, so she gives in and goes on back home. I rarely hear from her while they're honeymooning, except maybe a 3-minute synopsis of how hunky-dory everything is now, and because he's given her permission to go ahead and rip out the old carpet or buy some new dining room furniture, she's watching her money, which is why she can't talk long. One of my brothers is in prison for doing something stupid, passing counterfeit money, but he's not a criminal. And the other one's a lifer in the Marine Corps, so as far as taking advice from any of them goes, I'm skeptical. The deal is the men are dead in Denver, which is only one reason why I'm leaving. I'm tired of this altitude, all this damn snow, and this obsession with the Denver Broncos. For the last 3 years, my life has felt inconsequential, like nobody really gives a damn what I'm doing or how well I do it. From the outside, everything looks good. I've got a decent job, money in the bank, live in a nice condo, and drive a respectable car. I've got everything I need except a man. And I'm not one of these women who thinks that a man is the answer to everything, but I'm tired of being by myself. Being single isn't half as much fun as it used to be.
Terry McMillan, when was being single fun?
When I was in my 20s, before I had my son, before I became a mother.
Because
I didn't care. I wasn't so interested in getting married at the time. I was having a ball.
Uh-huh. And then you became a mother, a single mother, soon after becoming a mother. And I guess that changed things?
Well, I think once I was in my early 30s. It wasn't just being a mother, to be honest with you. It was being in my 30s. And then I looked up one day, and I was 35. And then I was 36, and then 37, and then 38. And then I said, wait a minute. Something is wrong with this picture. So, no, I mean, it's not like I'm miserable. I'm not miserable. But I would prefer that it not be this way. But like Savannah, I'm not ready to take whatever I can get. Because if that's the case, I would have been divorced 5 times by now. Because I have been proposed to. But then I looked at him and said, I don't think so. Not the rest of my life.
Does each of the 4 women in your new novel represent one of your friends or a certain type of woman?
I think more type. No, after having been threatened by a lawsuit for disappearing acts, I made sure. I mean, I even cleared some of these chapters with some of my friends to make sure that they did not feel as if they were being portrayed. But fortunately, women are a lot smarter than men. And a lot of my friends said, don't even worry about it, Terry. I've been in that situation before, and in some instances I was aware of it and some I wasn't. So they just told me, look, you know, a lot of this stuff we all can identify with, so I'm not taking this personally, because I didn't lift my friends' experiences and put them in the book. I made a point of not doing that this time around.
I want to get back to the lawsuit that you mentioned. And this stems back to the father of your child sued you after your previous novel, Disappearing Acts, because mm-hmm. he felt that the main character, the male main character in the novel was based on him, and he sued for libel.
Mm-hmm.
The case was was dismissed from the New York Supreme Court.
And the Court of Appeals.
Mm-hmm. What effect did this lawsuit have on you, you know, if somebody suing you for libel over a book of fiction?
Well, first of all, I mean, it really hurt me, to be honest with you, because I hadn't libeled him or defamed him. And if I had really told the truth, I mean, really told the truth, then I could see him being upset. But that's not what I did. I created a work of fiction. And so for him to come after me this way, basically, I mean, he did it for the attention. He did it basically to humiliate me. But I knew in my heart that I did not write this book with malice and that I had not portrayed him personally. And the character that I created and portrayed was accurate because I made him up.
I wonder how concerned your publisher was over this lawsuit, because it would have had, I think, a pretty chilling effect on other novelists.
Well, my publisher was very supportive because they knew, too. I mean, I told the truth in a fictional sense. And, I mean, Viking is really good, and this isn't the first lawsuit that they've had, and it's not the first lawsuit that's been brought against an author. It just so happened that this one got a lot of attention, and part of the reason it got the attention it got was because of his sleazebag lawyer who made sure he went straight to the New York Post, you know, and then other people caught on. And, I mean, it was newsworthy. And, I mean, that's what the media does. They look for dirt and they play on it. And that's what happened. So he had his 15 minutes of fame. So, you know, I mean, he embarrassed me more than anything, because I was more concerned that my readers would assume that I didn't have an imagination and that I hadn't, in fact, made this story up. And that was the part, I think, more than anything that I really resented, because it was fiction.
It sounds like this lawsuit, although it was dismissed, still had a chilling effect on you, because you said before you were almost afraid to really write about people that you knew after this experience.
Well, not so much afraid, but what happened was, I mean, I had to go through a phase where I realized that I was not going to let him paralyze me. And, I mean, I had to go through that first before I was able to just sit down and tell my story. Because a lot of times when you're telling a story, you don't know. To some degree, you don't sit there, and there's not this real clear line of demarcation where you realize what's real and what's not real, what you've seen and not seen, what you've experienced, what your friends have experienced, what you've read in a paper, a magazine, what you remember 5 years ago. You don't know, and that's why it's fiction.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. My guest is novelist Terry McMillan. Her new novel is called Waiting to Exhale. We're after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Novelist Terry McMillan is my guest. I'd like to get your reaction to something that David Nicholson wrote in a review of your previous book in the Washington Post. He wrote, "McMillan may have created a whole new category, the post-feminist black urban romance novel." What do you think of that?
Well, I don't like to think of my books as romance novels, first of all, but I sort of know what he meant. I think it was meant to be flattering, but I don't like to think of myself as being up there with Danielle Steele and Judith Krantz and the like. I think what he was inferring, at least the way I took it, was that you don't often see romance in novels by black authors. And I deal with sexuality, sensuality, a certain amount of eroticism. And you get to see black men and black women showing and demonstrating a certain amount of passion towards each other, where in a lot of our work it's absent. Not all of our work, because there are other people that do it, but it prevails in my work. Because I'm just interested in intimacy, to be honest with you.
Let me ask you about the type of criticism that I think this book might end up getting. One, the criticism that these women are too obsessed with men.
Excuse me. That's a crock of doo-doo. They are not too obsessed with men. The bottom line is this, is that if they were lesbians, they may be more obsessed with women, but it just so happens they're heterosexuals. And I don't think there's anything embarrassing about wanting a companion and wanting to be loved and wanting to love someone. There's nothing embarrassing about that. And, you know, there are too many of us out here right now walking around, parading around. We're living alone, and we're getting by and acting as if it's everything is just okay. But if you had it the way you wanted it, you would not be alone. And I don't see them as being obsessed because they have other things going on in their lives that they are as concerned about, their children, their parents, their jobs, you know, their own lives, their bodies, everything. It's not just men, but men fit into the whole picture as well. And I don't see anything wrong with that.
Another criticism I can imagine you getting is that you've made black men look bad.
Are you saying that?
No, I'm saying it's a criticism I can imagine you getting. I'm not criticizing you for it. I'm not saying you did that, but I'm saying, look, on the back of your book, there's a quote from Spike Lee, who's kind of predicting that you're going to get this criticism. I'll read the quote.
You don't have to read it.
No, I'll read it. I've got it right here. He says, "No doubt when this book is published, the author will hear once again, as Zaki Shange did for Colored Girls, Alice Walker for The Color Purple, and Gloria Naylor for The Women of Brewster Place, the cries that the black man has been wronged, the black man has been dogged. I disagree. Terry McMillan has crafted a well-written, truthful, and funny story of four African-American women, four sisters who are trying to make it in this world we all live in, and the sometimes volatile world of black female, black male relationships." Signed, Spike Lee.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously you're anticipating this kind of criticism, or your publisher is.
Well, you know, no, I don't think my publisher was. So far, I'm really kind of surprised. I mean, I've done about maybe five readings now, and the brothers are sort of coming up with, they wait to the end, till after everybody has asked their questions and made their little comments and stuff, and then they sort of almost eke out, do you think you're going to get criticized? I mean, they haven't, like, jumped on me yet.
What's the origin of that Spike Lee quote? Did the publisher ask him for a quote?
No, Spike read the book, and he said, you know, Terry, you know they're going to jump all over you. And I said, yeah, Spike, I know, but I told a story I wanted to tell, and I'm prepared for it because I'm not going to let the African-American community dictate how I tell a story. And also, when I tell a story, I wish they would just get it once and for all that we, not just myself, but other African-American writers, you know, we're not trying to represent the entire black race. We are telling a story about the characters that inhabit the pages of our book. That's it. You know, and the ones who usually are whining and complaining are the ones who are usually guilty. So I'm not falling for it. I'm just not falling for it. And they can't tell me what to write. And if they don't like it, don't read it. You know, it's some good brothers out here. And the brothers out here who are cool know who they are.
Do you think that there's a different set of problems in black couple relationships than in white couple relationships?
Well, yes and no. I think that all of us have baggage that we bring to a relationship, especially the older we get. I think that black men bring a different kind of baggage. They may bring similar baggage that white men have, but in addition to that, sometimes it's the racial thing. Some of the things that black men have been through, a lot of white men have never experienced. But then again, if we talk about humiliation, there's no color on that. If we talk about helplessness, there's no color on that. But with black men, if the cause of that helplessness is a result of racism, then that's different. Then it's different. But for the most part, a lot of women in general are just sick of being disappointed, sick of men who are afraid of making a commitment, men who are afraid of intimacy, men who lie, men who don't keep their promises. And in that sense, there's no color separation here. I don't know what it's going to take for them to understand that they're missing out on a lot of stuff by being such wusses and being so scared of everything. I mean, there are a lot of really wonderful women and beautiful and smart, intelligent women out here that they seem to be so threatened by and so intimidated by. And, you know, just because we are career women doesn't mean that we still don't want them or love them or care about them or want to share our lives with them. And, I it's as if men think that if they fall in love and it doesn't work, that they're going to die, you know?
When you were growing up, did the couples around you, the parents, or, you know, your friends' parents, the aunts and uncles, your parents, the other parents in the neighborhood, did they seem to have good relationships?
A lot of them did. I mean, there were some, I mean, where I grew up, people used to fight. I mean, literally hit each other. In my house, they did. My mother used to hit my father with frying pans, and he'd hit her and punch her lights out and stuff. I mean, violence was, it was almost everywhere. But then again, there were other family members who were more civilized. So I got to see both sides of the coin, and I choose to identify with the kind that was gentle and tender. I saw both, which is why I think I felt this dichotomy. Like, I didn't understand why men and women had to hit each other to make a point. You know, is this the only way you can vent your anger out on each other? And oftentimes, you know, the other person wasn't even the cause of the anger. It was some other stuff. And that's the part that used to baffle me, which is why one time I tried to kill my father for hitting my mother, because I knew she hadn't done anything wrong. I don't think we get that as much. I mean, there are still young men out here who think that the only way they can exercise their masculinity is by hitting their wives or their girlfriends. And they don't understand what it does to children when the children have to see this.
What did you do that time when you almost killed your father, when you tried to?
Well, not so much kill him. What I did was, I didn't know where I got the strength from. I literally just picked him up. And I think I was about 9 or 10. I literally ran between him, he and my mother, and I just picked him up by his shirt and threw him up against the wall. I've done it twice. I mean, I stopped a man from stabbing my mother once. I took the knife out of his hand and put it up to his throat and told him if he ever in his life ever thought about hurting my mother again. And I swear to God, I was getting ready to kill him. And I was 13, and I will never forget it. And he thought I was crazy, and I was. But not so much that I did it. But I had that knife puncturing his skin, and I swear to God, I'd have killed him. I just told him, you put your hands on my mother again, you're dead.
Who was he?
I don't want to say.
Okay.
I mean, it doesn't matter who he was. He wasn't my father.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, alcohol and drugs are usually what precipitates a lot of this action. You rarely see a man sober hitting his wife, unless he's really nuts. Usually it's alcohol or some controlled substance that causes them to go off. That's what I found to be true.
Your previous book, before your new novel, was an anthology of contemporary African-American fiction that you edited. Can you tell me why you wanted to do the book, what the inspiration was?
I mean, basically, I say it in the introduction that I was basically, and am still basically, fed up and tired of seeing all these anthologies that are published on an annual basis, you know, from Best American Short Stories to the O. Henry Awards, Editor's Choice, Pushcart. And there was no, I went back over 10 years up to like 1980 or 79, I went back. And there, I could count on one hand, or three, four fingers, to be honest with you, the number of African-American writers in these anthologies. And it really just made me sick. And I know a lot, I knew at the time of a lot of black writers who wrote short stories. And it really just angered me. And I mean, and just the other day, to be honest with you, right before I came to New York, I was at a bookstore in San Francisco. And there it was, Best American Short Stories, O. Henry Awards. So I wait until I get home and I open them up. Sure enough, same thing. 1992, they're doing the same thing. Every story in there is just about, if it's not from The Atlantic, it's from The New Yorker. The New Yorker doesn't publish black writers, let's face it. Jamaica Kincaid, maybe once in a while, I guess, John Wideman. You know, it's sickening. You know, it's sickening. Every year, it's the same people. And I mean, these are good writers. I'm not taking anything away from Joyce Carol Oates, Cynthia Ozick, same writers every single year. They might may as well not even have a contest, if that's what it is. They should just ask Cynthia to send them a story. And Joyce Carol Oates, send them a story. I mean, and they are good writers, don't get me wrong. But a lot of the anthologies that are smaller anthologies that are published by African Americans, they aren't even in the running. They aren't even in the running. And it's sick. It makes me sick. You'd swear we didn't write short stories.
When you're in the middle of writing a book, is it easy for you to keep up with fiction? And especially, I know you're especially interested in keeping up with African American.
You mean
fiction.
Reading?
Yeah, reading.
Well, no. It's hard for me to read writers. And I don't just read African American writers. I read Cynthia Ozick, Joyce Carol Oates, Ann Tyler. I read a lot of people. I try not to limit my. I want my world to be as large as possible, and that includes people of all ethnic groups, not just black people, because other people's lives and their backgrounds are just as valid as mine. But when I'm writing, I find it difficult to read writers who I really, really like. I mean, like, I love Kay Gibbons, Walker Percy, Toni Morrison, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You know, I can't read Zora Neale Hurston or Anne Petrie while I'm writing because I am too influenced. And plus my mind gets, I get wrapped up into their stories and I start forgetting about mine. So I wait. I mean, now I'm on a tour. I have basically 6 weeks. And I'm loaded down with books in my book bag of other people's work. And I'm very excited about the about having the whole summer just to read other people's work.
Terry McMillan, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Terry McMillan's new novel is Waiting to Exhale. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. John Robin Bates wrote the play The Substance of Fire, which is running at Lincoln Center. He just received a $15,000 playwriting grant from the National Endowment for the Arts. He accepted the grant, but he's giving $15,000 of his own money to two arts organizations whose grants were just vetoed by the head of the NEA. Coming up, Bates tells us why he's protesting what he describes as the NEA's censorious restrictions. We'll also hear from a spokesperson representing the NEA. That and more coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. The polls have just closed in Ohio, where President George Bush and Democrat Bill Clinton appear to be on their way to easy victories. Bill Cohen of Ohio Public Radio reports.
President Bush didn't even need Ohio's 83 Republican convention delegates. He was already over the top weeks ago. And the only question for Clinton is, when the votes are counted here, will he get all 151 Democratic delegates, or will Jerry Brown pick up a handful? Neither of the two Democrats had spent much time in Ohio. It could be a late night for people who are watching two key congressional races. In Cleveland, 16-year veteran Mary Rose Ocar is being challenged by six other Democrats. She'd been accused of being one of the biggest abusers in the congressional check-writing scandal. And in southern Ohio, all eyes are on a new district that two veteran Republican congressmen have been forced into. There's Bob McEwen, who's been in office 12 years, versus Clarence Miller, who's been in for 26. For National Public Radio, this is Bill Cohen in Columbus.
Polls are also closing in Alabama. Joint Network exit polling data projects Democrat Bill Clinton an easy winner in Ohio. The exit polls also give Republican President George Bush a victory in Ohio. Both ABC and CBS say their exit polls indicate strength for Ross Perot in California. CBS says that its exit polls also indicate that Perot might do well in Ohio and that many supporters of Bush and Clinton are ready to walk. Haiti's military coalition has named a leading conservative as prime minister. The move appears aimed at ending Haiti's economic and political isolation, which followed last fall's coup ousting Jean-Bertrand Aristide. NPR's Suni Khalid reports.
Haitian National Radio said Marc Bazin was named today as the compromise choice to become Haiti's new prime minister, following an agreement between military leaders and parliamentarians. Under the plan, Haiti's interim president and prime minister would resign, leaving Bazin as head of the military-backed government. The choice of Bazin, a businessman and former World Bank official, faces ratification by the Haitian parliament in about a week. But supporters of exiled President Aristide have vowed to oppose Bazin. 2 years ago, Bazin finished a distant second to Aristide in national elections. Since last year's military coup, Bazin, formerly considered pro-U.S., has aligned himself with Haiti's military regime. And Bazin has also opposed Aristide's return to power under a plan by the Organization of American States to restore democratic rule to Haiti. I'm Suni Khalid in Washington.
In New York City on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down over 17 points to close at 3,396.10 on volume of some 201 million shares. Declining issues led advances by only a slight margin. This is NPR News. In Bosnia, gunmen ambushed a UN convoy carrying food to residents of the capital, killing one driver. According to radio reports from Sarajevo, Serbian forces carried out this attack in a new violation of a ceasefire. Meanwhile, Serbia says it is stopping foreign debt payments in the wake of UN sanctions imposed last week for its involvement in the fighting in Bosnia. Fighting has also been reported in Croatia. In New York City, UN Secretary General Boutros-Boutros-Ghali said Croatian troops, as well as the Serbian-led Federal Army, are fighting in Bosnia. Last month, he had put most of the blame on Serbians and the Serbian-allied Federal Army. On the third day after the UN imposed tough sanctions in Serbia, officials in Belgrade continued to act defiantly, but they are also preparing tough belt-tightening measures. NPR's Sylvia Pajoli reports from Belgrade.
The Serbian Prime Minister Radoman Bozovic today reiterated that the sanctions are unfair and dismissed allegations that Serbia is the aggressor in Bosnia. He said domestic oil production has been increased to meet a third of Serbia's needs. The Belgrade Press reported today that a gas rationing program is being prepared that would restrict citizens to 15 liters, less than 4 gallons of gas a month. And today, motorists lining up for fuel found gas prices had doubled. In shops, supplies of detergent, soap, and pasta are beginning to dwindle. The pro-regime newspaper Politica said today that Yugoslavia would stop repaying its estimated $8 billion foreign debt because of the sanctions. This is Sylvia Poggioli in Belgrade.
Germany's defense ministry has proposed cutting its links to a four-nation $38 billion project to build a new fighter jet. Germany and Britain each have a 33% share in this project, with Italy and Spain controlling the rest. British Prime Minister John Major is to meet later this week in Bonn with German Chancellor Kohl. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. The record industry may be acting like they've just discovered Seattle and the thriving rock and roll scene in the Pacific Northwest. But rock historian Ed Ward says loud guitars and snotty attitudes are nothing new there. He says that part of the country has been putting its own spin on the rock and roll mainstream for over 30 years, including this latest hit.
Ah, yes, the record we're all tired of hearing these days. The record that has sent countless talent scouts to the Pacific Northwest, hoping that the constantly falling rain has inspired other bands to write a Nirvana-sized hit. But, as some of us already know, they've been making great records in the Seattle area for years. The first band to go national from the Seattle area formed, appropriately enough, around a waterproofing company. Don Wilson and Bob Bogle met at Sahara Waterproofing and almost immediately discovered that they were both guitarists. After a weekend of jamming together, they found some other guys and the Ventures were born, a band that was responsible for selling more guitars than anybody else in the pre-Beatle era. When Walk Don't Run went to the top of the charts in 1960, it opened up the floodgates. Curiously enough, instrumental music was a big part of the Northwest scene. Paul Revere and the Raiders began their career with an instrumental hit, Like Long Hair, and, at least until they turned into television stars in 1965, included lots of instrumentals in their live shows. And over in Tacoma, there were the Wailers, the first Northwest group to have an instrumental hit, Tall Cool One, in 1958. But in 1963, it was a record with a vocal, one you couldn't really understand, that made the Northwest notorious. Revere and the Raiders had discovered the obscure Richard Berry record Louie Louie, but it was the Kingsmen who had the hit with it, and they slogged around fraternity parties for the next 20 years playing it. After vocals, the next major discovery around Seattle was attitude. Certainly we can blame the Rolling Stones, but I don't think anybody perfected attitude in this country like the Sonics did.
Some folks like water, some folks like wine, but I like the taste of straight strychnine. Hey, you may think it's funny that I like this stuff, but once you've tried it,
unfortunately, the Sonics were too hardcore for AM radio in those days and only enjoyed local success. And by 1967, when the Daily Flash appeared on the scene, the paranoid rumor was that it was their name that kept them off the radio.
Take me to the night, I'm dreaming, topsy-turvy, turning upside down.
Likely is the 20-second blast of feedback noise that opened one of their singles, Jack of Diamonds, and the wimpy reading they gave Eric Anderson's Violets of Dawn that did it. But after that, Seattle was a wasteland for a long time. The best it could do in the 70s was stuff like this. Interviewing Heart, in fact, was what got me to Seattle for the first time, but I'll admit it, I could never stand their music. If only I had known there was more than that happening in the late 70s.
Here I'm laying on the line, giving me chills up and down my spine. Get to the Nashville wall, nothing I do can get to you at all.
The Wipers were one of a group of Northwest bands that never got heard during the punk explosion, paving the way for today's crop, like Soundgarden, the fabulous Walkabouts, and, of course, the guys who made the record we're all tired of hearing, Nirvana.
Ed Ward writes for the Austin Chronicle. This is Fresh Air. Playwright John Robin Bates has made an act of protest against what he describes as the censorious restrictions of the National Endowment for the Arts. Bates is best known for his play The Substance of Fire, which is running at Lincoln Center in New York. He was just given a $15,000 playwriting grant from the NEA. He decided to accept the grant, but to donate $15,000 of his own money to the two arts institutions whose grants were vetoed last month by Anna Imelda Radice, the acting head of the NEA. He's donating the money to galleries at MIT and Virginia Commonwealth University. Their grants were vetoed against the protests of the NEA advisory panels that voted to award the money. Both grants were for exhibits that included material pertaining to the body or sexuality. We called Bates to discuss his decision. This is an excerpt of the letter he wrote to the NEA.
I'm writing to acknowledge the grant of $15,000 awarded me by the endowment. I do so, I can assure you, without the least bit of pleasure. Being deemed politically acceptable by Chairwoman Radice is a dubious honor. It seems to be rather like having been given the thumbs up by the Vichy government in France during the Second World War. Specifically, I'm at a loss to find credible rationale for the Chairwoman's recent overturning of two previously approved grants. I'm referring, of course, to MIT and Virginia Commonwealth. Therefore, I'm making donations of $7,500 to each of these two institutions in protest over the chairwoman's actions. I do so with my own funds, not the endowments, which I will use in the manner prescribed in your letter, quote, to support activities which contribute to your creative development and may include research, travel for theater-related purposes, creation of new work, and revisions to work in progress, end quote. I simply will not be complicit with faux moralist sharpies of the right, nor with psychosexual hysterics in the cultural sacking of this country, which has once again become a favorite conservative pastime. This action of donating a like sum is my response to the manner in which the endowment is being compromised by Ms. Radich. We are more and more becoming a country afraid of ideas, afraid of ourselves, and the chairwoman's actions serve to substantiate this blanding of America, an America in which an inoffensive grayness, a dull gray artistic and cultural decency, will determine who and what we are.
Robbie, when did you decide to take this action?
I decided when I first read about the endowment's refusal to give those previously approved grants to the two institutions. I just decided on the spot when I read it. My annoyance just kicked in, and I thought it would be an appropriate gesture and response.
When were you notified that you were getting a $15,000 grant?
A few weeks ago.
So how long did you think about this decision before acting on it?
Immediately. I knew right away. I knew what I was going to do. I didn't know quite how to, and I sort of just planned it out in my head, and it wasn't particularly, it didn't take a lot of working out. I just simply was waited for the money to come in, and then acted.
Oh, so you waited for the money to come in?
Yes, to my, waited for them to give it to me.
Why did you wait?
Because I didn't want to jeopardize the institution's chances of actually getting the money. I talked to my lawyer, and you know, I had a completely legitimate legal position if I had to invoke one. I just didn't want to interfere with the real act of getting them their money.
Are you saying, in other words, that you were afraid if you went public before you got the money, you'd never get it?
I guess I was. Maybe I'm overcautious. I certainly have no experience with this kind of thing, so it just seemed like the right way to do it.
You could say in a way that you're going to be out $15,000 because now you have to, because of NEA accounting, end-of-the-year accounting, you're going to have to spend $15,000
on
playwriting.
I'm expecting to have to account for that $15,000.
I know you spent some of your childhood growing up in South Africa, in which you were exposed to many injustices, but in a way it wasn't your country.
That's right.
Do you see this as an opportunity to take a stand on something that's part of your world, part of your life, in the way that other things haven't been?
I think so. I think that's very accurate. I always felt that it was terribly easy for me in South Africa to take a position on anything, that I had no real investment in the life of the country. And I guess that anguished me in some way, but this is a very organic response. I didn't kind of try and come up with some sort of Barnum and Bailey stunt. I guess this seemed to me an absolutely natural response to and something that I could do, that I could afford to do emotionally, that I could afford to do financially, and it seemed intellectually right or something. That's about it.
What has angered you the most about how the NEA has been making decisions lately?
I guess what angers me is that adversity and complexity that ideas that are in opposition to a kind of mainstream safety have been found threatening in such a way that people who should know better, I guess arts administrators, I get a sense that there's such a fear of the right, that voices are being silenced. And I think what angers me is this idea of being complicit. And being co-opted by an establishment that is vulgar and trashy and invokes God and invokes patriotism and in fact knows nothing about any of those ideas whatsoever.
John Robin Bates, his play The Substance of Fire is at Lincoln Center in New York. We called the National Endowment for the Arts to find out what their response is to Bates' decision to accept their grant and donate his own money to the two galleries denied NEA money. This is NEA spokesperson Jill Collins.
We are always delighted when someone in the private sector wants to support the arts. And Mr. Bates has indicated in his letter to us that he is using his own funds, and he certainly has every right to do whatever he wants to do with his own funding. The $15,000 grant award that Mr. Bates received from the National Endowment for the Arts was to specifically support activities which contribute to his creative development and artistic growth. And we are certain that when he files his final report a year from now, that he will indicate that he used the federal funding for just those purposes.
What about the letter of protest that Bates sent to the NEA, in which he refers to the NEA's censorious restrictions? Are you going to respond to that?
No.
So the NEA isn't taking an official stand on his comments?
No, none whatsoever.
How come?
All that I'm going to take an official stand on is the fact that we are always delighted when someone in the private sector supports the arts, and that we are feel certain that a year from now, when Mr. Bates files his final report on the grant monies that he received from us, that they will show that he used those monies to support activities which contributed to his creative development.
Jill Collins is a spokesperson for the National Endowment for the Arts. This is Fresh Air.
I'm Linda Wertheimer. Coming up on All Things Considered, we'll be taking a look at the Earth Summit, which starts tomorrow in Rio de Janeiro. We'll have several pieces, including one from a dissenter who thinks that this conference should not be taking place at all. We'll also be looking at a poll conducted by ABC News and The Washington Post, which shows Ross Perot in first place in the contention for President of the United States. E.J. Dionne of The Post will be with us to talk about what that means for Perot and for the other two candidates. The United States Senate is debating the funding bill for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. That's all later today on All Things Considered from National Public Radio.
Keith Gordon, who directed the new movie A Midnight Clear, isn't a first-timer. He also directed the little-known independent feature The Chocolate War. If you saw him, you might recognize him because he's also been a movie actor. He starred as the heroic kid in Brian De Palma's Dressed to Kill and as the owner of a car with a mind of its own in the Stephen King thriller Christine. Is he better off directing? Stephen Schiff reviews A Midnight Clear.
Keith Gordon's talents as a director lie just where you might expect them to, in the way he works with his cast. A Midnight Clear has six central performers, most of them young actors you might have dismissed when you saw them in various John Hughes-style high school hijinks movies. Now here they are doing the best screen work they've ever done. Gordon wrote the movie, too. He's adapted it with enormous fidelity and care from a little-known novel about World War II by the pseudonymous William Wharton, the man who wrote Birdie. Wharton was 17 when he joined the Army, and the movie has preserved the novel's youthful wit. The narrator is sensitive and self-effacing and cynical and scared out of his mind, and that tone is what keeps the movie alive. It has to, because the story can't quite manage. A midnight clear is pretty familiar stuff. Yet another decimated patrol gets sent on yet another hopeless mission by yet another insane and narcissistic commander. This time, the scene is the Ardennes Forest. The time is Christmas, 1944, and the patrol is a squad of unusually brainy young soldiers led by a sergeant named Will Not, or Won't, as his comrades call him. He's played very well by Ethan Hawke. His orders are to occupy a house in unexplored territory and to use it as a radio post for a week, reporting back on what his men find. But the house turns out to be a chateau, full of fine paintings and good wine and eerily mocking statuary. It's all too nice and too easy, and then stranger things start happening. The patrol sees signs of the enemy, but the Germans don't fire on them. Instead, they sneak around at night, hooting and giggling. And when our boys throw a grenade at them, they return fire with snowballs. Eventually, this sort of behavior can unhinge you. In this scene, one of the young soldiers, played by Ari Gross, apprises Sergeant Knott of the initiative he's just launched against the enemy.
I got wet working out a little surprise for our Teutonic friends. What, a trap? Built a snowman. Right where we dropped our stuff. Used pine needles for a mustache, and then a branch, like an arm, giving the Nazi salute. I even put a few pine branches over one eye. It's not a bad resemblance.
Jesus, Stan. They could have come up from behind you, made a few well-placed critical comments, and one more ventilated whiz, kid.
In the end, you know the movie's going to be telling us all about the futility and absurdity of war. And the lesson doesn't feel a lot fresher this time than it did the last thousand. And as good as Gordon is with actors, he's no stylist. His ensemble scenes are lively and pungent, but he can't always get the mechanics of storytelling right. And sometimes it's hard to figure out just what he thinks he's showing us. Although the movie's climax is very nearly as stunning as Gordon means it to be, he fritters away the energy he's built up in a long coda that meanders when it ought to gallop. Still, it's good to see these faces. Kevin Dillon, Matt's little brother, playing more quietly and intently than ever before. Frank Whaley, who usually winds up in sidekick roles, playing the patrol's moral center with an unexpected poignancy. Ari Gross, who generally gets stuck in Weisenheimer parts, making his character excitable and vulnerable and tragic all at once. And Gary Sinise, the stage actor-director who starred in The Grapes of Wrath, playing the squad's lone nutcase with a lovely gravity. A Midnight Clear isn't a fully achieved movie, but there are a lot of terrific futures on display in it.
Stephen Schiff is critic-at-large for Vanity Fair. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, and Joan Tuohy. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.